Firstly, could I just check that you're here for market supervision? As much as I'm sure we all love to hear what President Trump is thinking about right now, I think this will be a more spiritually nourishing evening for us all. Welcome. Welcome to the London School of Economics. And before we really get started, could I just ask a favour of everybody? Could I just ask you to grab a wallet, if you have one, or a purse? Just take out your wallet or your purse.
Well, it depends what I'm being asked for, I guess.
Maybe some folds as well. Do you have it in your hand? Excellent. Could you hand it to the person next to you? Tightened up when that question was asked. It's interesting how money has a way of focusing the mind. And in many ways, that's exactly the tension that we're going to be exploring tonight. When organisations exist to solve social problems, what happens when money enters the equation? Does it strengthen the mission? Does it reshape it? That idea, the relationship between markets and mission, sits right at the centre of tonight's discussion and is exactly the kind of question that universities are well placed to explore. And at the LSE, we spend a lot of time studying the causes of things, how economic systems work, how institutions shape outcomes, and how social relationships shape the world around us. And one of the patterns that's become increasingly clear over the last decades is that many of the biggest challenges we face today no longer sit comfortably between what is public, what is private, and what is civic. Those decisions, once neatly described the world, they seem to do so less now. And those questions, for us, are essentially ones about private action and public benefit. And that is what our work at the Marshall Institute focuses on, and the reason that we have convened this lecture series as part of the LSE's Impact Economy Project. Now, the project is exploring a simple but important question. How do we shape an economy where social and environmental outcomes are part of how value is created rather than external to it? And that question shows up in so many different places, in public policy, in capital markets, in philanthropy, and very clearly in social entrepreneurship, because social entrepreneurs sit right at the heart of that intersection. They are solving social problems, but they're also building organisations that need revenue, resilience and scale. In that sense, we think social entrepreneurs are some of the most interesting hybrid organizations in the modern economy. They live every day from the tension and the opportunity between mission and market, which is why the research that we're going to be discussing this evening is so interesting. It looks at a very practical question. How does grant funding encourage social organisations to develop commercial revenue without undermining their social purpose? To my mind, that's asking the question of how can philanthropy and markets reinforce and align rather than compete and conflict? So, we're going to start this evening by hearing from the research team about their work on match trading and what they've learned from it. We're then going to open into a wider conversation with our panel about what this tells us about the evolving relationship between markets and mission. And then we're going to hand over to you and have questions on all of this, which I'm really looking forward to. But first, let me hand over to the team behind the research we're discussing tonight. And I'm very fortunate to hand over to two brilliant colleagues. First, let me introduce, they are the research team. First, let me introduce Professor Jonathan Roberts, Teaching Director at the Marshall Institute, and one of our architects on work on social business and entrepreneurship within the broader London School of Economics. and also Dr. Karen Keha, senior lecturer in practice at the Marshall Institute, whose research focuses on social entrepreneurship and the social and solidarity economy across a wide range of international contexts. Together, they take the research into the match trading model we're going to discuss tonight. So, Jonathan, Karen, over to you.
Everybody, and a very warm welcome to what is a very green room. It's lovely to see you. Jonathan and I have tried really hard the whole day to curtail this presentation to 20 minutes, so you're going to have to start giving us steely looks if we go over, but there is a lot to say and there's a lot to talk about. I will do the introduction and just set the scene for why we decided to work with the School of Social Entrepreneurs on this research project, and we'll close and lead into the panel, and Jonathan will present the findings. Before I get started, because I know what happens when you start presenting, you forget really important things, is that the two people who I'd really like to say from all of us a really deep and heartfelt thanks. So that's to Joe and Robin, who are with us in the audience today, and particularly to Joe, who's held my hand through many of the research interviews and processes, and we wouldn't be presenting this today. So, a couple of quick questions. We all work in the social space where there is this narrative that social organizations are dependent on grants. Grant dependency is bad. And earned income is this panacea that brings autonomy to organizations, it allows them to be independent and to make their own decisions. But together with this is this tension between commercial behaviors that come with introducing earned income and the social mission, the primary purpose of the social organization. And if we continue to encourage organizations to develop earned income strategies, what do we sacrifice in their social mission? And this is one of those big, important questions that we need to be able to understand more deeply as policymakers and as ecosystem enablers and as social entrepreneurs. Complicating this is the deeper narrative that funding often doesn't suit the type of organization that it's directed at, particularly when we're starting to talk about large-scale impact investing strategies, which are very out of touch and out of sight to small, local, micro, community-led organizations. But often we also don't acknowledge the other side of grant funding, which is that it also acts as a disincentive. It disincentivizes organizations to seek commercial behaviors, or at least to seek earned income strategies. So these are the questions and the issues that Jonathan and I are grappling with, and one day we enter into a conversation with the School of Social Entrepreneurs, who starts talking to us about their match trading program, and here we have an opportunity to really deep dive into understanding this tension between the commercial and the social that really sits in our world. I'm going to spend a bit of time quickly explaining what the match trading program is about, seeing it is central to our entire research study. But what match trading is it's an enterprise grant. But what makes it really important is that it's got three key components to it. The first is an incentive mechanism. So the organization is incentivized to earn an income, and for every additional pound that it makes, it receives a matched pound as a grant. So we see this incentive to trade. What's important, though, is that this incentive is capped. For the organizations that we studied, that incentive is capped at between 4,000 and 10,000 pounds. So we talk about small pockets of money, but powerful incentives. The second thing that is really important here is that all of the organizations that participate in the match trading program, they apply to participate, they get selected, then the leaders have to attend a monthly training program, an action learning project that really introduces them to the management systems and the learning environment that they needed to really improve on their management strategies. And lastly, linked to the first point about incentive, that grant is itself a third component in the match trading program. Because the grant is what we would call conditional in that it does need to be spent towards the strategic objectives of the organization. But there's also an unrestricted feel about it in that there's broad ability for the leader to spend that grant that additional money that comes in through the earned income strategy on the, what they see as a priority for the organization. And so you can see how in this magic triad that there's an opportunity to really start to understand, well, what is the effect of commercialization on social organizations? And also, what is the effect of this incentivization to commercialize? Does it have a positive or a negative impact? And this essentially leads us to our three research questions. I must acknowledge that we build on excellent research that is done before, which really evaluates the scope of the match training program. But with our three questions, we were able to deep dive into the behaviors. So very quickly, before I hand over to Jonathan, because this presentation is all in the findings, is research question one, what is the effect of participation in the match training program on both the behaviors of the individual, the leader, as well as the organization? And then this opportunity to really deep dive into more broadly, what is the effect of developing commercial capacity in social organizations? Is this a positive or a negative effect? Does it help the organization to fulfill its social purpose, or does it take away from the ability of the organization to fulfill its social purpose? And then very interestingly, what is the interplay between grant and commercial income? We can understand then the nuances for something that we often see as opposites. Our research study, 14 social entrepreneurs, social leaders. It's lovely to see some of you in the room as I'm speaking. I see you. It's really a very warm welcome, and thank you from all of us. And we deliberately selected organizations who were diverse in terms of where they are in the country, in terms of what they do, education to health, and also diverse in terms of size. So small, micro, to quite large, well-established organizations. I'm going to hand over to Jonathan to lead you through the findings, and I will step back in at the end of talking conclusions.
Great. Thank you, Kerry. So welcome, everybody. And if I could just repeat Karen's thanks to Joe, Robin, and the whole team at the School of Social Entrepreneurs. They were an exemplary research partner, and we're so grateful for all your diligence on our behalf. So thank you. Okay, so we've got these two different research areas that we were looking at. Most of the time, I'm going to be focusing on the match trading program itself. And our research approach, really in-depth qualitative experience and interviews, enabled us to understand fully what this program was doing for the people we talked to. And then at the end, I'm going to say a little bit about the broader picture, this picture of the interaction between the social and commercialization, and also this very interesting area of how do grants and earned income interact. So let me start with the match trading process itself. And what is so interesting for us as researchers, but also for the wider field, is this idea of this conditional, this contingent grant. So we're familiar increasingly with the idea of outcomes-based contracts and grants, where you only get your money if you've created a certain social impact. But this is something curiously different. You only get your grants if you've actually improved your commercial revenue, which really intrigued us. So I want to focus for a little time just on that idea of that incentive. And we found that there were three particular trajectories or dynamics going on for our particular group of social leaders. One of them was what we call push to the next stage. And a number of the leaders told us that their organization, yes, it did embrace some sort of commercial activities, but they had got, the language was, stagnated, or they had plateaued, and they were going nowhere with their commercial activities. And this grant, with an incentive, pushed them to think about, can we go to the next level? Can we provide more services? Could we charge just a little bit more for our services and not harm our social mission, and so on? So this was one group where it was the push to the next stage that this grant was enabling through its incentive. The next category was something about innovation and risk-taking. So there were a different category of social leaders who had an idea for how they could do something new in the area of commercial revenue generation. but they just weren't quite having the impetus to put it into practice, or actually it just looked a bit too risky to do it. And again, what this incentive did was encourage them to take that leap, to move into this innovation. So the example we have on the screen there is a work integration social enterprise. So it's employing vulnerable people to help them get into the labor market. And in this case, they had a couple of markets they were in, but they were considering another market, but didn't take that leap. This incentive encouraged them to take that leap. And if you think about it as well, there's a double return for them, which mitigates the risk they're taking. So they're not only, if they're successful, getting an increase of revenue of £6,000, they're doubling that if they are successful. So it changes just very slightly the risk profile of this innovation. The final action of the incentive was for those, it was one or two organizations, two in fact, I think, who had not actually engaged with commercial activities before. And so this was just an incentive to try it, to take that leap again, to go into commercial activities, come up with some idea and just see where it goes. So we sort of got these different categories of a life cycle, almost stuck in a rut, wanting to try something new, or just beginning to go into this field of commercial earned revenue for a social venture. So I thought that was quite an interesting typology which could inform the future design and indeed choosing the ventures that might take part. Excuse me. Moving on to the training program. Well, the training was unsurprisingly valued in and of itself for a number of reasons. The first one is that it created a network. And for those of us who've researched training, this is not unfamiliar. Actually, one of the biggest values of training in the social sector is not actually the training. It's being in the same room with a bunch of good people you would never normally meet who are all facing the same problems. Because it's incredibly isolating to be the leader of a social venture. And again, this is something that other researchers discovered. It's just not a network that is there for a year. It can create a network that lasts for a very long time. So that kind of network effect is really important. It's also something we find on our programs at the Marshall Institute, that just us getting people in a room is perhaps the most important thing that we do. The next one benefit of the training was, yes, the skills development, but I want to focus on something in particular. And that was the creation of professional systems in an organization. Sometimes in our world, that can be viewed as something which is a little bit harmful. If we get more professional, then maybe we're driving out that volunteering, that informality, and so on. The perceptions of these leaders was that was not the case. And actually, this professionalization was not just about the commercial activities they were doing, the systems they were learning, but spread into their social impact activities as well. So for them, this process of really learning how to think as a manager systematically was very powerful. Then there was the equally powerful idea, I think, of increased confidence. Many social leaders running organizations did not start off as managers. They started off as a nurse or a teacher or a social worker or something like that. And even though from our conversations with them, it was really quite obvious that they were extremely competent, they didn't necessarily feel that competence because they were very aware of that gap in their trajectory, that they had never been trained in how to run an organization. They had no experience of financial accounting and so on. So the benefit of the training program was simply, yes, learning more skills, but also validating that they actually did know something and they actually could be a leader. And finally, again, I'm sure this will be familiar to those of you who are social leaders. There's never time to breathe when you are a social leader. You are responsible for this organization. It's very, very small. You probably have to do the plumbing as well as the accounting, as well as lead the social impact. There's never time to think strategically. And what this training program did was force people to have a breathing space. The other thing that people said to us was, we can't take any time for breath because we will feel guilty if we did that. And the idea that by doing the training program and having the grant, they could earn £6,000, £12,000 for their organization, that justified taking the breathing space. So there's quite a complicated interaction. Another thing which we found, which I think was really, really interesting, was a change in mindset. And that was mentioned by quite a number of the people we talked to. But I want to be really clear about what that change in mindset was, because often in this field, we talk about the antagonism between the social and commercial activities, and that many people who are social leaders, commercial activities, earning income, profit, these are sort of dirty words. So the mindset is a moral mindset. And if we're changing it, we're moving from the idea of commerce being offensive to commerce being something we can embrace morally. But that wasn't the case for any of these leaders. And I think that's partly because they had been acclimatized to the idea of commercial activities by previous interactions with the School of Social Entrepreneurs. They were comfortable morally with the idea of commercial activities. So what I want to draw attention to is a very different kind of change in mindset. And that is a change in mindset, which is about cognition, not morality. It's about the behaviors we have, the way of analyzing the situation that we have, the habits of mind that we have. So what we found was that the leaders were much more attuned to commerce and the practices of commerce than they had been before. Not unsurprising, given the training that they were undertaking. But I think it's quite important to understand that this means you look at the world in a different way. And I've got some examples here. You see a commercial opportunity where normally, previously, you would never have seen it. And that's a habit of mind. Alternatively, perhaps controversially, you begin to see the users, we might call them beneficiaries, as consumers. Now, for some, again, that moves into the realm of being a little bit offensive. But actually, for these leaders, seeing some of the users as consumers meant, well, what is really going to appeal to these people? How can I make this more accessible to them for the price that I am charging them? And from that as well, you get a connection to certain scripts. So again, I'm talking about cognition, the way your mind works, the way it thinks in relation to a particular situation. You have different scripts. So you still have your script of caring for people, wanting the best for them, but you also have this script of how can I monetize? What is my pricing strategy? What is my marketing strategy? And so on. So you have this whole different set of scripts in your mind, which increasingly become habitual, just as your social scripts are habitual. So we found that really interesting, this change in mindset in a cognitive way. Moving quickly on, Karen's mentioned that there is this really powerful set of dimensions in mass trading. And we did indeed find that the mass trading program is more than the sum of the parts. The interaction was very important. So let me explain. The first thing is that the conditional grant forces you to actually enact your training immediately. So if you want to get the grant, you've got to do something. And you've got to do something straight away in your own organization. So this is experiential learning at its most powerful. Sometimes we can think of experiential learning just as kind of doing a case study in a classroom. This is way away from that. This is actually having to enact your learning straight away. Connected to that, a lot of training actually simply is embedded in an individual. And you never know really whether those skills are just with the individual or actually going into the organization. But again, because you've got to earn this money through your own organization immediately, that means these skills and learnings are being transferred to the organization immediately. So connected to the experimental point, it's just a bit different that it's organizational, not individual. And the final dimension, of course, is that the grant is money, and a small amount of the grant comes whether you're successful or not. But the rest of it comes if you are successful. And we found that a number of organisations were using it as an inherent part of their growth and commercial activities, their innovation. The grant was catalytic capital, to use our academic jargon, which was enabling these organisations to enact the training that they had been given. So we see all these interactions between the three parts of the programme. So that's what we found about the experiences of the programme and trying to explain why it might work. So we're very interested in that incentive system. Just a few quick comments about the broader environment of social enterprise. I should emphasize that the way our research was constructed was we were relying on the reports of the experiences and perspectives of our participants. So when we say that the participants felt that their social mission was not compromised by growth in commercial activities, we are relying on their word for that. We did not check, we did not evaluate, and so on. So please bear that in mind. But what we found for these leaders was there wasn't this big tension between social mission and commercial activities. Sometimes the commercial activities were in fact entirely aligned with mission. So obviously the case with the work integration social enterprise, where the more staff you can employ, the more vulnerable people you are helping. But also the case when you are charging users a fee for services. The more services you can provide, the more fees you get, and the more users you can attract and help. We also found a really interesting finding specifically for work integration social enterprises that the leaders reported to us that their vulnerable users who were learning to get back into the labour market, it was very important to them that they were not part of a charity or what seemed to be a charity, that they were part of a successful commercial enterprise. So in that sense, there's a really, really strong relationship between commercial growth, professionalisation, and the validation of users. The final point is simply that, as reported by our users, the professionalisation of services forced by commercial growth also meant that they were more professional in dealing with social problems. So we see this interesting alignment, which we hadn't entirely expected. Then finally, of course, there are tensions. It would be ridiculous to say there aren't tensions between social mission and commerce at times, most explicitly, of course, when we are charging users for a service, because a fee can be a barrier, of course. But what our leaders told us was, well, you can manage these tensions. And again, they were a very eloquent group of users, so we need to bear that in mind, our leaders. But they were saying, yes, there are times when fees can exclude people, but in those cases, we have variable fees, and if someone really can't afford it, and they can show that, then we will have a no-fee situation. So there will be tensions, but they will manage. Very final point from me is about this balance between earned income and grants. So the earned income, the increase in commercial revenue was very welcome for a number of reasons. Simply, it provides extra resources and therefore more sustainability. Grants were criticised because they can be very arbitrary. You don't know whether you're going to get them or not. They can be taken away suddenly and you don't expect it. So it created more control for the organisations where they're getting their revenue from. So that sense of organisation control generated by earned income. And a lot of people talk about the desperately fatiguing process of putting in many, many grant applications. It's a familiar story. But what was interesting for us was that nonetheless, there was a belief that grants had to be part of the funding mix. They had to be. And that's because most of these organisations considered they could not be fully sustainable in a marketplace because of all the extra costs of the social mission that they had. Grants could also perform certain functions, like you could go more in depth with the quality of what you do, you could innovate with the grants, or as that quote says, you could expand your services. So I think what I don't like is this binary opposition of grant versus earned income, and this idea that if we raise the earned income, then the grant goes down and it's a zero-sum game. I don't think that's how we should perceive it. I think we should look much more at what is the functional use of earned income for these organisations, how does it benefit them, and what is the functional use of grants, and how can we combine them in interesting ways. And one of our suggestions for future reserves is that's where we should go. So that's enough for me. I will pass you back to Ariel.
So to wrap up, what are the implications? As Jonathan's talking about, we really are looking at the hybridity of social and commercial behaviours and the strength of combining these two together. So the strength of the enterprise grants and match trading as a program is this combination of the incentive with the matched funding and income together with the training program. And it is in this hybridity, it's in this combination that we really see value. We also recognize the importance of action learning, particularly for organizations working in the social space, where we constantly are re-evaluating and being flexible and responsive to the environments that we're working in. There's real value to action learning as a process. And as Jonathan spent time explaining, this mindset shift that occurs that really allows us to see opportunity in new spaces and places, because we're not seeing social and commercial as opposites, but we're actually starting to see the world as it is in its full complexity, and that full complexity being its hybridity. What about the developing commercial capacity? What we were both really struck by is that I suppose we did go in there expecting more acute tensions between the social and the commercial incentive, is that the social comes first, and that the commercial then is a means to an end to achieving the social in the majority of cases. So the tensions are there, but they are small and that they are managed. And I think this is really an important insight as we step more meaningfully into the complexity of hybridity. Jonathan spoke beautifully to earned income, and grants are complementary. This is not a zero-sum game. They are not opposites. And one of the things that really struck me was the professionalization of processes and management systems within the organizations as a consequence of the incentive to trade. And just from an academic perspective, when we look at how organizations build stability and the stability that's needed to grow or to expand, deepen service delivery, having that managerial competency and the ability to manage your logistics is crucial. And so one of the positive consequences is really the professionalization of services as we introduce more business logics into these organizations. And so really it enhances, and this really came through strongly, it enhances the social mission rather than compromises it. And lastly, so where to from here? So we'll have a wonderful discussion coming up in the panel, and we're all looking forward to your questions. As researchers, we always want to research more. I think there's extraordinary value in the longitudinal study to see how sustained these changes are within an organization over time. I think we're all curious about what are the optimal balance of grants versus earned income that exists in this funding mix, recognizing the importance of both. For policymakers, I think there really is an opportunity here to expand the concept of an enterprise grant and match trading into almost non-social community-led businesses, where we know that they generate extraordinary community and economic value in the areas where they're situated. And lastly, this is a provocation from us, because we see the changes that happens within the organizations themselves and how they adapt and adjust. But what is it that we as funders, as policymakers, and as ecosystem enablers, what changes do we need to make in our mindsets, particularly for funders? What are the changes that we can make in our mindsets to create better funding and financing vehicles to suit the complexity of the environment that the organizations are responding to? And with that, I hand back to Kieran and to the panel, and we're looking forward to the discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you. Thank you, Karen. Please take a seat.
Gosh, there's so much in there. So much in there. Really looking forward to this. I'm left with visions of hands, of head and heart. So hands, you're describing things were done differently. I'm really struck by that sense of head, though, that cognition, the different ways of seeing the world. And then really struck by the points around heart. You know, what did people feel that this was doing, what this was enabling? Particularly struck by the social came first. So these are some of the topics that we're going to pick up on. I'm delighted that we're going to be able to pick up on that with the rest of our panel. So if we can invite Ali and Tim to join us here. Brilliant. Can you hear me okay? If I wonderful. Yes,
thank you.
So, well, I'm brilliant. I suspect these two gentlemen need little introduction, but let me do it. Let me do it briefly. Firstly, may I introduce you to Ali Wilson, Chief Executive of the School of Social Entrepreneurs. Over the past two decades, he's supported thousands of social entrepreneurs to start to grow organisations tackling some of this country's biggest challenges. Not just in the UK, but also internationally as well. And Ali, you always bring such a grounded perspective of what this really means. And we're also joined by Tim Davies-Pugh, Chief Executive of Power to Change, an independent trust supporting community businesses across England, and one of the organisations closely involved in developing and supporting the match trading approach that we've been discussing. And of course, Karen, who spoke so eloquently through that research. So we're going to be ambitious. I'm going to try and structure the conversation in three widening circles. So first, we're going to start inside the organisations. So really get your sense of what did match trading change for those organisations? What happened in practice? Second, we're going to take your question on. We're going to zoom out. We're going to say, well, what does this actually mean for funders and the wider funding system around those enterprises? And third, we're going to zoom out even further than that and say, well, what does this mean for the economy? What does this mean also for the future of social impact organisations? We're going to do that all in 5 minutes. Give you plenty of time to ask other questions as well. So let me start with the first question. And Karen, I'm going to turn to you. So the first area about what happened on the ground. So Karen, as you went through the research, I'm just really struck by what was the single most interesting change that you saw in the organisations? Perhaps what you expected to see and then what you actually saw.
I think what's interesting is that the change that the organisations saw in themselves and then the change that we saw when we started to look at all the respondents. Social leaders are often just in survival mode. And are just managing the day-to-day, but this opportunity to step out, the training program really just, Jonathan said it so well, just creating that breathing space, really gave them an opportunity to think. We know this as educators, the value of creating that breathing space, but what really struck me when you start to look at the broader profile of the organizations is that professionalization within the organizations is also linked to a culture change that allows the leaders to create breathing space in their everyday. So their ability to be able to delegate to other members of staff, to not be the social entrepreneurship leader who does everything. One of the quotes that we have is, you know, I'm blocking the toilets and then I'm dealing with members coming in and then I've got to report to the board. And so that ability to build, to they do trust their staff, but to delegate many of the operational staff to operational details to other members of staff or volunteers, I think is really important because it allows the leader to lead, it allows them to focus on strategy, and it brings breathing space into their day-to-day. And I think that is one of the really important elements in terms of sustaining the effect of the professionalization of the organization.
Thank you. Ali. What did you hope to see
through this? Through the research or in terms of the impact?
The research was brilliant, but actually through the actual program itself.
The program itself, it's worth taking a step back for a second in terms of these people are choosing to trade in broken markets, they're choosing whether it's a place or whether it's a theme. It might be a cafe storing all the people into work. It's obviously not as profitable or as able to earn all its own income as Costa is next door, because you have six vulnerable people in your workforce. And therefore, they do need grant. But what's important is how we administer the necessary medicine of grant in a way that's congruent with what these people are trying to do. I mean, at the moment, you know, in the existing kind of funding setup, they're going to do this very strange dance where, if you like, on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, they're running a cafe. And on a Thursday, Friday, they're working out how to put in applications to trusts and foundations. The return on investment of the trusts and foundation applications is huge. You know, you can spend half a day doing an application, you can get 50 grand in. You sell tea, coffee, and cake in a cafe. And you're lucky if you clear, I don't know, a couple hundred quid in a day. So they do need grant, but how we administer the necessary medicine of grant in a way that allows them to build their resilience and sustainability and walks in kind of lockstep with them and is in service to their vision and their mission and their community. I think that's what's important. And I think for me, what we hope Match Trading and the programme would do was to de-risk the idea of customer acquisition. So, by the way, just to make clear, it works for B2C customers, like a coffee shop helping all the people to work, but equally it works for B2B or B2G. It's just interesting to hear Ken and Jonathan's point about some more vulnerable or poorer communities where the beneficiaries is not a commodifiable or saleable product, if you like. And so often through the learning program, people twig that they've got to unpick and unearth a proxy market. So in other words, it might be a local authority or a housing association or a health trust who can help provide the market, which means they can transition to selling and selling more and growing, and then give them an engine of growth. But it's really about allowing them to hold to their vision of what they're trying to do, and meaning the people who provide money and support are in service to that.
So I'm getting quite a lot of kind of autonomy, control. Yeah. Those are, was that the experience?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's ultimately any funder, and there's loads of converts in the room here, there's loads of people who back Match Trading and really support us to get it to this stage. But ultimately, I mean, if I was a funder, even over the last 20 years or whatever, what really makes your social change happen is agency and power and voice. And so if you're in hoc to X, Y, and Z funder, I mean, you've got to be, because these things won't wash their own face. But how much you're in hoc and what the power imbalance is and how you mitigate that and what your business model is in order that you can edge, if you like, agency and power for your community and shift things, because ultimately that's what we're trying to achieve.
That's a great point to move into our second circle then. And Tim, I'm going to move to you. You're an early backer of this work. So did I was too, previous life. Let's come back, because I guess you go out there, so much focus is on what social enterprises should do differently. So much of the meds or the prescriptions you get are about what social enterprises should do differently. But your question was, well, actually, what does it tell us about what funders can do differently or how they might conceive the world differently? So Tim, would you just kind of explore that perspective?
Yeah, thanks. I think there's probably two answers to that question, because I have two funder experiences. So the early backing of Match Trading was when I was director of the lottery. I guess the reason for kind of picking it up and backing it at that point was lottery, big funder, obviously most of it was very traditional. Granted, it started to explore into how it perhaps worked in investments and social investment. But there was a lot of kind of conversation at the time around the power imbalances between funders and grant recipients and how people could try and address those things. I think what was interesting about Match Trading was it shifted that power balance quite significantly. And in one sense, you've almost got a slight partnership or a kind of almost a joint venture between the two things. because the funder clearly wants to deploy its money, get the outcomes. That's its job. That's what it kind of is trying to achieve through the deal. And therefore, the recipient, the match trading recipient, is also then trying to trade and draw money towards it. So it has its incentives as well. And suddenly, it's different to sort of saying, okay, as a funder, here's a big lump of money. We're buying these outcomes from you. Kind of, we want you to deliver it, and you know, don't come back until you have, sort of thing. So it's sort of slightly shifted the sort of power balance a bit. And then I think leaping forward into Power to Change, the organisation I run now, and its kind of use of match trading, we still run a match trading program, Trading for Good. The notion of community business, our community enterprises, are very much that they have to trade. That is one of the key components that we see as important. And that's important because it gives them agency and ability to create sustainability from day one. And often the individuals involved want to be trading in something because of the type of activities they're involved in. And that can be a sort of community shop or a pub, right up to a sort of regeneration or house building, sort of energy regeneration scheme or house building activity. But that same sense of actually wanting to be in control is a kind of key factor. And I guess in that relationship, the match trading scheme gave us the ability to bring new entrants in kind of quite a low risk way. So they could try kind of getting their trading model up and running. They weren't having to either take on a large amount of debt by borrowing. They didn't have a burden of a kind of big grants. And then we talk a lot about professionalisation of people running businesses, which is an absolute key component. I mean, definitely back that. But there's also something about professionalisation of fundraising. You know, grants, you know, applying for grants takes a degree of knowledge and understanding. And often the people that we were working with in terms of segment community businesses weren't well versed in the sort of voluntary sector grant making regime. So again, actually, this gave them a route into something they could understand, they could really kind of get their heads around, and actually allowed them to operate in a way that they want to operate in, as much as, you know, benefiting what we want to do in terms of funding.
Yeah, thank you. Ali, why don't more funders do this?
I scratched my head about that. I mean, what I say is, this is just for me, this is entirely weird, Kieran. Having worked with, you know, 20,000 social enterprises, all of who come to us, I can tell you hand on heart, if you look at the buckets of money at the moment, right, you've got traditional grant, and there's billions in that, and you've also got social investment, and there's billions in that now. And I can tell you, because these people are choosing to work in broken markets by place or by theme or by whatever, I would say less than 5% of them need pure grant, traditional grant. And equally, less than 5% of them can cope with even blended social investment and payback with interest. Because what they're doing has, you know, a social cost to it. If you have six homeless people in your cafe, it's not going to do as well as Costa. So there's a degree of grant needed, probably in perpetuity, but what we can do is we can nudge people up to their optimal trade ratio. And so for me, I think there's two big opportunities for funders. One is to make their money work harder. I mean, why do you need to kind of give it all away as 100% grant when loads of trading charities and social enterprises don't need 100% grant? They need, in some cases, they need 50%, 70%, whatever it is. But so there's with tech and data becoming easier, cheaper, more sophisticated, we can begin to have benchmarks all around the country of what every cafe, what the trade income can be for every cafe supporting homeless people into work all around the country. So we can know that the one in Plymouth earns 30% of its income and the one in Aberdeen earns 80% of its income. So there's something about how they make their money work harder and don't give it all away when they don't need to, and make their money work further. But also, there is what's weird for me is, why is there this missing middle? Why is it all assuming everyone needs 100% money, or everyone needs just a loan and you can pay it all back?
Because
share, finally, and 90% of all the social entrepreneurs in social enterprise agreement don't fit into either of those two categories. The supply side money is in those two huge lumps. Why? It's weird.
Karen, does it have to be philanthropy that is doing that funding? Is there a role for states in doing this?
In terms of funding, co-funding, sharing programs, I think the role for states is complicated and needed. I think it brings legitimacy to alternative funding forms. And I think the role of the state also can bring legitimacy to micro, small, community-led organisations. I think, I mean, I'm South African, but I, you know, globally, we really do see the legitimisation of large businesses being the big goal at the expense of understanding the real value and social returns that small, micro, community-led, even often informal businesses bring. But of course, the state can bring value as a funder of enterprise grants, but the difficulty with public funding always is that it's politically led. And so I think I come back to the same point that
some John... people may say that philanthropy is
true, but I think this is the point that I'm going to make, is that what the narrative around earned income was always that it would ease the power inequalities that exist with grant income, that exist with getting subsidies or grant or funding from the state. And so now we're opening up the funding mix. I think what the research shows us is that there's real value in the funding mix that brings not just sustainability, which is the word we hear, just stability. And especially in the world as it is today, I think it's the traditional channels are becoming more unstable, or certainly less certain. So to answer your question, yes, I think there is a crucial and important role for the state, obviously in terms of policy, obviously in terms of legitimacy, obviously in its role as a funder, recognizing that it gets value out of the social organizations that are delivering services that are, you know, largely public services that should be provided by the state. But, and this is an important but, there's really important to be a champion of the funding mix. And I'll say one last thing, if you don't mind. I mean, I'm a champion of social enterprises. That's my work. That's what I study and do. And I think the social enterprise narrative has very much created this us and them, this earned versus ask income. And I think it's really important, come back to it again, but say that that funding mix is everything.
Brilliant, thank you. Let's move into that third circle, partly so you can start preparing your questions for the panel. So that third circle, so what might this tell us about the broader economy? What might this tell us about the future of social impact organisations? And so, throughout all of this and the conversations we had before, I've been reflecting on this word hybridity. Take the colour green. Do we call that a blue-yellow hybrid? Or do we just call that green?
And so I guess if organisations are combining social purpose with commercial activity in this way,
are we right to think of it as a hybrid and a niche? Or are we actually just saying this is its own model that we should recognise in the mainstream economy?
So I would say the latter. I think, you know, this isn't something that we should be distinguishing as vastly separate. And I think there's something about trying to think about the impact organisations are trying to make, rather than how they go about making that impact. And at one level, there's been this kind of, you know, slightly based about commercialisation that's driven through match trading. I suppose my view would be, well, if it works, then that's just let it can happen, really. And certainly for us, it's about the value and the social values and the kind of ideals that the organisations are holding. And that can be a kind of entirely commercial organisation, or it can be a social enterprise. You know, they can both hold value and purpose that is important. I think what is interesting about this particular model, and this, I suppose, reflects the work that we're interested in and Power to Change, is it actually gives you a slightly different way of allowing these organisations to interact with the economy. And not the social economy, but just the economy, because that's what it is we're talking about here. And this is a really important sort of way of saying, actually, they have a role to play. They're often operating in very challenging markets. Access to finance is very difficult. This is a way of allowing them to enter into that market and start, hopefully, climbing up a sort of ladder that allows them to be taken seriously and receive other funding as they sort of, you know, manage to get a foothold. And in one sense, your previous question about should the state be funding this, I mean, I think absolutely mainstreaming this is absolutely vital. And if you think about it from a dynamic modelling point of view, you know, all of these things that are happening, are trading, are generating income, they're employing people, you know, lots of value that unfortunately we're not very good at measuring, so therefore we're not very good at making the case that Treasury should actually take that seriously. So the investment here through public money is actually rewarded back here through all of these other values that can kick in.
Final question to you, and then I'll turn to the floor. How big can this get?
I mean, what's interesting about it is it's only ever been done in the UK, and I think it just came up with it just because it was a very annoying thing. A lot of people would come and speak to us about it, so we just came up with a kind of solution.
Is that because other places have solved? Other places don't need it?
No, not at all. I mean, I think in terms of development funding globally, I think, you know, the potential is absolutely huge. I think, personally, I think the reason is because the narrative and the debate often comes from those who run the finance systems, not from the practitioners. And therefore, they're used to dealing with systems where, you know, you have in banks, you have debt, and in grant funders, you have grants. And it's social entrepreneurs and social enterprises aren't dictating the terms in which the money and the investment comes to them. If they were, it would be more sane and more logical, and money would be being passed around. But in terms of how big it could get, Keenan, I think, to my mind, it's something quite interesting. Excuse the crudeness of this example, but think of homelessness as an issue. I'm quite involved with various acts and homelessness. And homelessness is a fully broken market. I mean, you know, it takes hostels, it takes outreach workers, it takes cost. That's what homelessness is. And you can use much trading to eke out markets, think of good ways of trading, give people dignity, help them get into private rented accommodation, pay their own rent, workforce needs, etc. So you can nudge charities and social enterprises from being broken markets, if you like, to get into a sub-market optimal position. And then equally, you have some amazing social enterprises like the Lights Change Please, which people might have heard of, which are really sub-market optimal. And you can nudge them using tools like this to get them to be able to really unleash growth through working with blended social investment and the impact economy. So there is opportunity to massively scale this. But to your point earlier on, the government has got to see the opportunity in this. If I was the government and I was looking at loads of communities up and down the country where, High Street's dead, there's not a lot of money circulation. If I could find a policy tool that would help kickstart growth, even if it was saving me 50% of what I'd otherwise have to pay, if it was a fully grant-dependent intervention, I think I'd be interested. And I think with this particular government and the impact economy, I think it's so exciting that we've got this government here. And I think we need to try and work out how we can get them interested in creating and adopting tools that work for people who are choosing to work in broken markets. They're not choosing to work in functional, rich markets with functional people. They're choosing to try and kickstart activity and in these other communities.
Thank you. We've got so much experience in the room. The panel are all convinced. They've spoken about power, agency, voice, partnership, stability, representation, opportunities for governments to think quite differently about economic development as well. So I'd love to hear your questions, more than make them tricky questions. Do make them questions. as well, because if you do that, then we can get through more. And we've got a microphone going around. There's so many hands up, and what I'm actually going to suggest is we start taking them in twos to begin with. So I can start with the front row, please, and here. Thank you. And if you just say who you are.
Hi, James with Alethi from Generation Success. You guys spoke about it seems like funders are very aware of the power dynamics, but one of my key things is about who gets access to funding and who doesn't. How can we use match funding to help change the risk appetite of funders in order to make sure that more community, more leaders get the funding they need and who are currently locked out of the funding economy?
Interesting. Yeah, I've got a similar type of question. My name is Joanne English and I'm from an organisation called Queertopia Consortium. I actually completed one of SSE programmes and that's how we got the funding to start our social enterprise. My question for the panel would be, marginalised communities, we understand that black and brown particularly, and LGBTQIA+ social interest companies find it very difficult and challenging around funding and actually receive the least amount of funding. Lots of times barriers around match funding is also a huge barrier because they're not necessarily being funded. So how do they then go from being grassroots, surviving on £1,000 a year, donating 100 hours a week, you know, doing the work? How do they then progress?
Thank you. Ali?
What's amazing, so 1,400 organisations have had match trading grants. The average uplift of traded income within a year is 35%. The control group, this was a piece of work research done by Power to Change, the control group, which had traditional grants, achieved an uplift of 9% in the same time. So you can see that the nudging and incentivization absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt, works. But what's interesting about that is when you've got a data set of 1,400 organizations, and you can cut it for LGBT, for ethnicity, for this, that, the other, or for IMD areas, you can see how different groups are doing. What's absolutely fascinating about that, and we didn't expect at all, was that Black-led organizations were outperforming their white-led counterparts in terms of traded income at a particular turnover size, so between 1 and 100K, so relatively early stage, virtually 2-to-1. So in other words, the uplift of traded income of black and minoritized groups was twice that of their white counterparts. Now, interestingly, as the turnover threshold went over 100K, it didn't entirely reverse, but it partially flipped. And so our hypothesis is twofold. One is that because of the way that networks work, and particular groups hold the keys to certain power bases, etc., two things are going on. One is, if you are minoritized, you understand prejudice, you've lived with it all your life, and you are going to make damn sure that you hustle and you make sure that you can trade and you make things work. So the natural entrepreneurial zeal to make business models work makes sense to us. Then when you get to the larger turnover group, your networks and connections might be all right in your local community, but do you know the people at the top of the tree who are holding all the power and all the money? Much more difficult. So what we've done is began to look at quite dedicated market making courses where we link up particularly diverse groups to the market makers in order that we can sustain the overperformance into the higher turnover areas. And I really think that these types of non-economic tools are key to unlocking some deeply entrenched unfairnesses in society. I think
Tim, is that your experience, Power to Change?
Yeah, very very much so. I mean, the research that we did echoes that, informed that. I think so two things. One is the question about how we get more people to do it. So this data, the research, and a group of organisations acting on the umbrella of the Enterprise Grants Task Force is acting to try and promote this amongst funders. So we have a very strong membership of people who are coming. They're not all practitioners of enterprise grants, but what we're trying to do is those who are practicing it are sort of trying to talk about the benefits that we've just been discussing, how it could work for them, some of the barriers that they might, prejudices they might hold against it, and so how it's all a bit complicated or how they work in practice. And we're starting to sort of slowly bring people into the movement who are now adopting it. We've had, a couple of funders in the last 12 months who have joined, moving into enterprise grant stuff. Because it isn't, it seems terrible having all this research and pieces around it, but actually it's really simple. It's kind of like, you're basically giving somebody match money for every pound that they're making trading. It is not rocket science. So both from the funder's perspective, they should be able to roll this out really, really quickly.
From a funder's perspective, it seems to me I'm Lucy Blythe. Look me up if you need to. to encourage this kind of tool, because I see it actually as a tool in the whole spectrum. It seems that awareness of this as a tool is the most important thing. So how do we do that? And I'm just wondering, because Kath Dovey asked me today about this toolkit for MPs to try to get them to encourage philanthropy. What can MPs do to encourage their local communities, as the government has an interest in spreading philanthropy throughout UK, not just in London? And also, could community foundations have a role?
Thank you. Hi, I'm Rhian Sonsteiner, and I'm head of paediatric research at the NHS in Wales. Is it cutting out? I can stand up and shout if that's easier. So I'm head of paediatric research at the NHS. You've kind of discussed a lot around broken markets. Paediatrics, especially around development of drugs and devices, is one of those broken markets. I don't know if you're kind of experts in that kind of the medical grant kind of field or the kind of the science, but just a question around the catalytic change that you've discussed tonight, which is amazing. Do you think that could be used kind of in that medical grant environment? Because what we find when we speak to academics and industry is that there is a massive gap between what academics see their role as when they are developing or doing the basic science work and what industry needs from them to get to a point where they can actually take that risk on. So just wondering if you've got any views or opinions on that. Brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you both. Can I focus in on two aspects of them? So one, there was an assertion that awareness of this tool is the thing that's really needed. So I'd love you to explore that. Is that true? People are aware of it, they love it, they go with it, or is something extra needed about? Karen, you might start with whatever you learn through the research. Then I think there's that broader question of, well, can this model, can this approach be used in other ways? We've described here how it might work in community businesses, but you're describing other social purpose areas where it feels like our current economic system is not serving them well. And Tim, I might turn to you on that. But Karen, is awareness enough?
No, I don't think awareness is enough. I think it needs legitimacy, and what is legitimacy? We're really looking at how we can get multiple layers of people to really understand at a much deeper level what is needed and to champion that. And the word authentic is overused, but to champion it in a really genuine way, because they walked into the rational and authentic, which is exactly what Ali was saying, which is that small micro community, often informal, out of the spotlight, organizations are doing really great work in communities that the public sector struggles to get to. So these are legitimately organizations operating on a frontier. And because they're operating on that frontier, really deserve quite acute support. How do we bring legitimacy? It's about trust building. It's about bringing the sectors of society. You're talking about marginalization, but you know what's invisible to us, and really making that more visible, which really requires championing. It requires research, because we bring legitimacy. As you're at LSE, we're an academic institution. We've shone a spotlight on Match Trading, and just through that process, there's now a legitimacy gain. And so I think there's a combination of factors that really are needed, but that we mustn't focus on just awareness of a tool. I don't think that's enough. We really need to focus on how we can bring legitimacy to community organizations, and how we can enable the ecosystem to support them, rather than them always having to adapt to an ecosystem that hasn't been developed for them.
Tim, can I ask you a punchy question? Not could this be applied in other areas? Because I think the answer to that is yes, it could be. Would you like it to be? Or do you think there's something very important that we're discussing here about enterprise and business and community models that's somewhat separate from other social challenges, hugely important as they are?
Yeah. I suppose my response would be, no, I think it should be used where it can make a difference. I mean, a different way of sort of fixing an economic model that isn't working seems like, you know, well, why shouldn't we, really? And if somebody can find a way of using it, I mean, I should say, if anybody can find a way to make match trading work in different ways, then Ali will do it. So it seems like there are kind of lots of sort of challenging markets. I wouldn't use the term broken markets. I think they're challenging. But I think there are lots of challenging markets, and we're interested in trying to make the economic system just work better for people and get better results in whatever the emergency. So if there's a way of making it work in your medical thing, then yeah, bring it on. I can't see it, but as I say, I'm sure I will be beavering away tonight.
Now, could I ask, if you've got your hand up, can you keep your hand up if you're a student here at the LC? Or were a student? In the middle there, and then lady with her hand up. Thank you.
I'm happy to just shout. It's all right. My name is Francisco Ortiz. I'm head of impact and strategy at Bloomsbury Football. I did my master's here in SIE as well, like a few years ago in 2022. Have a couple of questions. One is, I would love to know more.
Just one, please.
It's going to be hard because they're connected. LSE. What's the difference between the size of organizations that you found in this study between splitting into like the trading income or just going for like grants? I think that it might change between the size of the organization. And the second one was connected to a Bridgepoint study, which is a consulting group in the US that they did this analysis that found that I think about 90% of the charities that broke the £50 million in like revenue concentrated on one income stream. Yes, you can say social enterprises, charities are different organizations, but in the end, we're talking about resource allocation and being able to like grab those resources. What can we say about those studies that are showing that organizations that are specializing in one income stream by actually using commercial assets, knowledge, but maybe professionalizing grant making are being more successful?
Thank you. Good question. Hi, thank you. I'm from the School of Public Policy, the Master in Public Policy, representing LSE at the Turner Mint Impact Investing Competition also. I have a question around the incentive alignment that match trading does, so that these companies, social enterprises, can boost their commercial strategy. Is there something that can be done from the demand side, for example, like the demand side, at least for example in climate enterprises, there's a challenge there if there's actually uptake of the product they're developing. So there's going to be a challenge for the companies to actually grow commercially if the demand side doesn't change behavior, or it's if there's not appetite there.
They're really actually at some level they're challenging the model, aren't they? There's a question there, which is actually when you get really big, it's actually turned out that you shouldn't have been hybrid. You should have locked in on something, and then we're hearing, well, actually, does this really limit you to those areas where there are extended commercial opportunities that actually some places just may not have? Ali?
You're teaching them so well that I'm not quite sure I can get you understood. I mean, certainly, for instance, I mean, if you think about the climate crisis and the kind of economic opportunities in the back of the climate crisis for poor communities up and down the land, I mean, you can just see how this can trigger inclusion for all sorts of communities to have a stake in the growth agenda. It doesn't need to be necessarily a social enterprise, it could be a commercial outfit. So I see massive opportunity. In terms of, the chap's idea of, like, if you really focus and get a single revenue stream, that's how you can achieve growth. Well, loads of these social enterprises, in their early stage, they've got to do this weird hybridity thing because they've got to, get grants and identify what they're doing. And also they might be trying different things, they might be trying different business models. They do eventually crack the best business model for them, and then they zoom in and focus on that. Now, the reason they don't get 50 million is a whole other debate and another lecture for you here. But it needs to do with their investability and their, the fact that often they're not for a private gain and they don't have a share base, and it's difficult to deploy large amounts of capital. But there's nothing in mass trading to encourage them to back 15 business models. I mean, they can be as disciplined or as ill-disciplined as they wish. So I'm not sure if I quite got the question.
I think describing kind of a transition, the vital role that this plays at a certain stage in an organisation's journey.
I also think that there's a sort of slight danger, because we're talking about earned income and grants, that somehow we're thinking about two different income streams. Mm-hmm. And they kind of are two, if you were legally writing it down, but they're driven for the same purpose because both are linked for income. So, while the grant money is grant money, it is actually being earned as part of the income generating. So I'm not sure it's quite the same as somebody who might then kind of apply for a £200,000 grant over here as a pure piece of grant, and then be earning some income because they're running a community cafe over here. I think that's where you get two income streams. I'm sure there's a kind of semantic point in all of those things, but that's why I'm kind of seeing it as a kind of focus on one income stream.
Thank you. Karen might have also understood the questions. So, Karen.
I'll give some insights on maybe on both, but I think you asked about what's the difference between the small and large organisations. Was there a difference? I think the thing with large organisations is that they're less flexible, but I still think, and picking up on this point, is that we often fixate on the amount of money that comes into an organisation and not the type of capital or assets that are coming into the organisation. And we forget that with smaller organisations, it's not all about money. It's about relationships and the community hall that you're operating in and the people who are able to come through the door. And so often, and academia is guilty of this too, we tend to isolate and only focus on the financial as being the primary means of capital resources coming into the organisation. I don't think that's the case. So the larger organisations, they're slightly less flexible, but they're no less important in terms of leveraging multiple types of resources coming into the organisation for its benefit. And that answers the question, sort of, on the demand side, because they're not operating with a pure business logic, where there's always this kind of supposedly perfect link between supply and demand. The demand side will invariably always have, there's always a constraint in the social entrepreneurship system. It's how the organizations navigate the constraint, which is where we need to focus our attention, not on the fact that there is a constraint.
Thank you, thank you. I've got good news and bad news. Bad news is we've really run out of time. Good news is that we're going to be able to have a drink afterwards and continue the conversation. So I'm going to actually take the chair box and finish with one final quick fire question to the panel.
If we're back here in a year's time,
probably two things. One is, why on earth is this only being done to the tune of $4,000 or $10,000? Why is it not being done for $1 million? Because of the transition issue. I don't know. And two, how seriously Ken's legitimacy point in terms of the scaling of this thing. I would really like if the government got behind this. There's a lot of major funders in the UK have got behind this now. We need the government to move on this. Thank you. That will really legitimise it.
So don't echo those two points, particularly the money sort of things. I suppose the thing that I would add into that is I would like to see more evidence in terms of the kind of the economic data to be able to make the case better. Because I don't think we're very good at that at the moment. So I think being able to prove the economics of why things like match trading work really well would allow that sort of dynamic modeling, would allow states to engage, mainstream funders to perhaps engage more in this activity.
Thank you.
Well, legitimacy would always be one of mine, but thank you, Ali, for championing that. Social enterprises exist because they respond to context, and because they respond to context, they are shaped by that context. And therefore, they look different wherever we are across the country. And what I'm glad to see in a year's time is that appreciation for the variety, the glorious variety of organizations, of organizational forms, of ways of bringing resources into the organizations, and picking up on the legitimacy point, really a much deeper appreciation of the work that is done in on this frontier of entrepreneurship and thinking and humanity.
Thank you. Scale, legitimacy, variety. What I've really loved about this conversation is so much is framed in terms of binaries. I've been scribbling it down around markets all worlds, trading all subsidy, enterprise all charity, and it doesn't really seem to track very well to what's actually going on in the world. It feels like the question is actually how do those things interact and how do we see them as a whole? And because we're at the LSE, it's worth saying that it's 250 years ago this week that Adam Smith published Wealth of Nations. And everybody who's read Adam Smith's work says and sees that he really spoke about how markets have to have a moral sentiment. So in some ways, these are not new ideas. I guess the question for us is how do we design our economic system now to take advantage of them? I think we've heard some really brilliant, fantastic ideas this evening. Definitely feels to me the sorts of questions that we should be discussing over a drink. So that's where we're going to break to next. You're to continue the conversation with the panelists, with the researchers.
Just one thing, just to say, to the earlier point about legitimacy of this thing, the LSE putting this on and doing this research pro bono for us with the A team that they've put together is phenomenal, and I'd really like to thank them for doing that for us.